Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We are the podcast of the S1 Project. Our mission is to reclaim the public narrative, shifting the lens through which we see our shared common life from the default lens of politics and economics, and using humanistic learning, and especially moral philosophy and humanistic theology.
Moving us beyond the binaries to get us, move us closer to a place where we can embrace and build together what some have called the kingdom of heaven. A kingdom, kin, K-I-N. That is a world in which, you know, all are fed, all are clothed, all are housed, and all are free to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah,
I guess.
A vision of the good.
A vision of the good.
We have a spinny wheel. We use the spinny wheel as a way to get into our show, a little limbering up. We spin the wheel. It has a sprinkler head as a pointer. It points to one of 16 different core values and key ideas. I've repopulated our spinny wheel with some new categories this year. So I will give it a spin.
Go for it, Chris. Yay! We've landed on the S1 Project. So those of you who have been following us for some time now are familiar with the What in God's Name podcast. The project actually grew out of the podcast.
Yeah, we've kind of done it backwards.
Yeah, we did. We did it backwards. We used to be a podcast with a project, and now we've expanded the vision so that it's a project with a podcast. S, because S is the letter you put on words to make them plural. One, because one is singular. And because those of you who've been listening for some time know that Chris and I are constantly pushing against the binaries, we included them both. S1 Project.
Yeah, it's a play on unity and plurality. It's a play on individual and community. Again, seeing these as not a binary, but as intention. Always in a society, there's, or even in a family or any organization, there's a tension between the individuality of the people who make up said community and considerations of the whole. Of the community, of the family, of the organization. And how does the individual interact with the community? How does the community interact with the individual? There's also a theological riff on this for those of us who are Christian and who follow that path. And the theological riff there is, and I'm sure actually other religions could do it too, but from the Christian perspective, we talk about, we understand God to be three persons, but one God. And so that tension of plural and unity is present theologically in Christianity. And I imagine in others, but I can only speak to Christianity.
Well, I can speak for Unitarian Universalism as well. We hold a number of principles. It's up for debate right now, whether that's seven or eight, whether we're moving beyond the principles altogether. But in the old seven principles, the first one was we covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of each person. The last one is we covenant to affirm and promote the interdependent web of all existence of which we are all a part. So between those two is a balance of unity and diversity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lovely. That signals the end of our riff on the spinny wheel and turning towards our topic of today. I did some writing recently in response to an article in Religion News Service about an organization called the National Association of Christian Lawmakers. And our conversation today is not necessarily, well, we'll talk about them, but I was in my writing more interested in the response to groups like the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, a response that says religion should be separate from the affairs of the state, which the separation of church and state is the phrase that's used. And of course, that's important. That's the separation of church and state, the words directly in the First Amendment against the establishment of religion and prohibiting the restriction of free exercise of religion, all of that is, of course, important. My point in my writing was there are moral conversations that need to happen in our society, and if we are continually retreating as a and generally this happens with religious people who tend towards being left of center in the political spectrum, if those people are continually retreating behind the phrase separation of church and state as a way to disengage or to not have the moral conversations, to not join, to use the metaphor of battle or fray, to not join the fray and to argue for moral visions for our society and even policy, then
we've ceded the moral high ground.
We've ceded the ground. Thank you.
We've ceded the moral high ground to the religious right, indeed, who have absolutely no problem jumping in there and articulating their position.
Yeah. So filling that out, parsing that out, filling in the blanks.
And I really, Chris, I really appreciated the article overall, because I think, and I've said this any number of times, that that those of us who are both religious and politically left of center on that political spectrum do way too often cede the higher ground, the higher moral ground, to the radical right. And I know it's hard. These days, if you're religious and left of center on the political spectrum, it's hard to imagine getting out there and speaking a morally conscious argument, because you don't want to be seen as, you know, the religious right, which, for the record, is neither in my book religious or right. And I think we've lost much of the language in which to have those arguments, by not teaching things like civics in school. People don't necessarily understand the depth and breadth of the First Amendment. They know separation of church and state, separation of church and state, and that comes down like a hatchet on the conversation. But it's like, okay, legally, yes, laws ought not to be passed based on one group's preference or another. But there's a lot of room for discussion, undergirding the laws that are being passed, that could help us at least arrive at some sort of common notion about what is right and what is good. You talk about the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, and frankly, I mean, I'm kind of done at the name.
I get you.
You know, because that's not a conversation. These are people who exist, who are out Christians, and they're out there to pass laws that are Christian because they believe that it is their right to do that. I do think that flies in the face of the First Amendment. If you're not even having a conversation, if you are not listening to people with different perspectives than of your own, and I'm not sure that the role of Christianity or any faith is to step into the political arena and pass laws. I think there is a role for witnessing, to speaking and to making the case and winning the hearts and minds of people. I think Jesus said it so succinctly when he said we are to be in this world but not of it, that we have an obligation to speak a good moral argument that hopefully will win hearts and minds. The laws will never be enough.
Yeah, excellent. So let me ask you a couple of things. One, well, the first is not a question. All right. So it's a statement of clarification and specificity. So the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, just so our listening community understands, one of the things they advocate is overturning Obergefell, which is the Supreme Court decision that legalized gay marriage. Another of their, this is from their website, another of their priorities is making abortion illegal, just abolishing abortion. And I think the important distinction that you've raised, Shana, is that they are the National Association of Christian Lawmakers. I want to emphasize the lawmakers piece of this. So what I hear you saying is that you want to make a distinction. I think we do need to make a distinction between the conversations that happen in the public square versus the laws that are made in legislatures, and that. Let me just stop there. Am I so far so good?
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, I guess, sort of in my ideal, it is out of the conversation in the public square and recognizing the depth and breadth of positions mm-hmm. held by mm-hmm. citizens that we would be able to arrive at, you know, laws which were reasonable. I mean,
I mean, what you've just described is you believe that because there's a moral good in listening to diverse perspectives and trying to incorporate them wisely into public policy. Yes?
Yes. Yes, that having been said.
And
there are also some universal maxims, philosophical maxims, which we have to be able to ground ourselves to. And I think we've lost some of those, which makes getting to so that all we have is diversity of perspective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We
okay.
have
yeah.
no anchoring.
Okay.
Which we talked about a little bit in the last
show. No, that's
show,
brilliant. But, so can I respond to that?
Sure, yeah.
So to steal, do you know the expression to steal man somebody's perspective? It's the opposite. It's doing the opposite of straw manning. So when you straw man somebody's perspective, basically you take the weakest version of their argument and attack it, which is simple. You know, steel manning somebody's perspective is trying to take on their perspective, their argument at its strongest. So I want to steal.
Take it on and challenge it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
So
you're going to steel man?
I want to steel man the National Association of Christian Lawmakers.
Good. Okay.
So, and in response to the last thing you said
about philosophical maxims.
About philosophical maxims. Because they would say,
or universal truths.
Or universal truths.
Okay.
They would say it's a universal truth that murder is wrong and abortion is murder. So then what do you do? Right? So
find out how many of them support the death penalty, for starters.
Well, okay, that sidesteps the dilemma. And let me try to spell out the dilemma. Okay. Because if we're going to resort, I think you're right. We need to resort to, and we need to excavate the universal or the maxim or the good. What is the good? So I agree with that. But what if that isn't good enough? You know, what if you come to loggerheads, and I don't have an answer to this, but I think what happens is you get to a place of I'm pounding my fist together. Like
what underlies the argument? Like, what underlies the argument murder is bad is that life is sacred?
Okay, so this, you're doing what I think needs to happen. So carry on.
So if what underlies the argument is this notion that life is sacred, which I think is something we could largely agree on, then the question becomes, is there ever a time when it is okay to terminate life?
Okay. That
So now we're having a conversation. Now we can get into the moral and ethical foundations about things like right to die or death with dignity, termination of embryonic life. Of, you know, because we're and just war theory. Hello. I mean, the thing that I think drives most politically liberal people absolutely batshit is when those on the right, on the one hand, want to outlaw abortion, but are pro-death penalty and are the biggest chicken hawks anytime America has an opportunity to go bomb the crap out of somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, so we clearly haven't gotten into the deep earth of the conversation because we got stuck up here at the disagreement.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, that's so thank you for, like, you said that better than I could have, because I think that, so if we think about public conversations and how they go, and if they become what we hope they will become, which is more grounded in those kinds of moral perspectives, then what I've heard you say, I would just use the word nuance. What happens is, if you're, and it's just like any good conversation, that when you hit, when you hit an impasse, you try to go underneath the impasse to maybe find, like you identified, oh, the sacredness of life. I believe in that too. You who are against all abortion, you claim for the, you know, that life is sacred. I believe that too. Okay, from that common ground, what can we, where can we go with
then
that?
Then we work our way back up to the flash point as opposed to just having the conversation burst into flames and self-immolate. Yeah. At the level of disagreement. But I think, you know, sometimes, you know, when I was reading your article and you were talking about the NACL wanting to undo, I've always pronounced it Obergefell, but you pronounced it Obergefell?
I've always heard Obergefell.
You say maybe Obergefell.
Yeah, whatever.
And again, Obergefell was the case for marriage equality. And you write that instead of criticizing NACL's advocacy for reversing Obergefell as violating the separation of church and state, what religious people and non-religious people for that matter ought to do is articulate the moral and theological good that the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause guards. Now, I totally agree with that. Too many of our citizens today do not understand these amendments, do not understand the Constitution. And I think that lesson needs to be paid very careful attention to, particularly now with respect to other conversations that government officials are trying to shut down in our schools and not allow us to teach. You cannot, if you keep dumbing down a nation, who was it who said, if you keep doing what you've always done, you're going to keep getting what you've already gotten, right? If you plant pumpkin seeds, don't expect tomatoes in the fall. You know, we're planting squash and we're getting squash, and it's not helpful because we have largely now really a citizenry that is uneducated to the finer necessities of democracy. Mm-hmm. Who don't understand its founding documents, don't understand the amendments written thereunto. And so, and then at the helm, right? So the people in charge of democracy, they're not actually governing, in case any of our listeners, you know, have been asleep for the last couple of years, decades maybe. They're playing a whole different game. The game they're playing is stay in office. So throw red meat to the base, keep people fired up and pitted at each other so that you can get reelected. So there's nobody at the helm.
Yep.
And the citizenry is potentially on the verge of really being incapable of standing up for democracy. Yeah. We're in some deep feces right now.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that.
The angel of darkness here this morning.
You know, I'm usually the angel of darkness, and of course, I can't disagree with you at all. And another angel of darkness who's writing a lot in the Atlantic online is Tom Nichols. I would love to get him on the show. I would love to get him on the show. He's writing very similarly as you are about Americans kind of sleepwalking. I mean, he uses the phrase sleepwalking. So that's just a rejoinder to your final comment. I want to say this about civics education. I don't disagree that there's a general lack of knowledge about the structures, the documents, as you've outlined. I want to take that a step further and say civics education then also needs to be about, this gets back to our theme for the year, it's not just about the structures and the processes, but it's about the moral foundations of the structures and the processes. That's what I'm advocating.
And it's not just about those moral structures. It requires us to learn to embody those moral structures.
Yeah.
We have to learn. We have to like start teaching people how to listen again. I mean, do you remember a while back? I think it came up during the Me Too movement, where there was a whole series of reflections on what is an apt apology. Mm. And it was the first time I had heard in the public square somebody talk about, you know, an apt and appropriate apology doesn't just say, all right, okay, like, whatever, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry you were aggrieved about that. That's not an apology.
Right.
And, you know, an apology, for example, begins with a reflection on what I did, how it may have felt to you, because without reflecting an understanding of both what I did and how it impacted you, when I get to the, and I am so sorry, that is absolutely not what I intended, or I am so sorry, I am a complete and total doofus, and I screwed that up, and what can I do to help make it right? You know, without the reflection of understanding, when you get to the end of it, that doesn't mean anything. So, you know, it's things like that. How do we listen to one another? I remember taking a class at Hampshire College. It was like one of the best classes ever. Philosophy and Affirmative Action. So we started the class at the beginning of the year. The professor asked, how many people support affirmative action? It's Hampshire College. We're a bunch of liberals, liberal white elites. And of course, everybody supports affirmative action. We talked for, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes about philosophy. And then we divided into two teams. And the first half of the semester, team A argued for and team B argued against. And then we flipped. And then when we got to the end of the semester, he asked the same question. So how many of you support affirmative action? And it was amazing because the entire class was like, well, you know, that's a complicated issue. And he just said, and that's philosophy. And my head almost exploded. It was breakthrough education. I was like, oh my God, I got philosophy at a core, like without having studied the classics and the, but now I understood what that school of thought is about. It's about realizing that, you know, the singular perspectives are just that, but they're not the only thing that exists. And we need to begin teaching that again. We need to begin working that into our curriculum. We're now in a period in time where teaching morality and ethics is not only not taught, in some states, they're making it illegal. So here, in the S1 project, legal or not, we're doing it. And inviting all of our listeners to stay engaged with us as we find our way back out into a world in which we can see one another and hear one another and feel each other's pain as well as celebrate each other's joy. We hope that you will stay with us on the journey.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
I'm giggling because there's like a million things I want to ask you, but we kind of have to stop. Don't we?
We'll pick it up next week.
Okay. What did I say?
Stay curious, Chris.
And what did you say?
Go deep.
All right. And shine a light. Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. If you are a generous donor on Patreon, we are so grateful. It's not a lot of money to you, but it means a lot to us. And so we ask you, if you're not a generous donor on Patreon, to go to Patreon. Please consider going to Patreon and supporting this kind of conversation. And not only between Shana and me, but as we move out and our project goes out into the world, supporting these conversations in different venues and in different places. Go to patreon.com and put in the search bar, "What in God's name?" And you will find an amazing picture of Shana and Chris and Brandon. If you want to be on our newsletter, you can send me an email, as our website is currently under repair. Send an email to whatingods@ribeye-media.com. That's whatingods, one word, at. You know, that's that little A with a circle around it? Ribeye, ribeye-media.com. Shana, what a pleasure.
Always, Chris. Always a pleasure.